It's the Red Tag Sales Event at Jeff Weiler Chevrolet of Columbus. Look for the red tags and unlock unbeatable discounts on new and pre-owned Chevys. 0% APR on select new Chevrolet for well-qualified buyers. From the rugged Silverado to the sleek Malibu, every tag means savings. Financing made easy. We'll pay off your trade no matter what you owe. Stop by Jeff Weiler Chevrolet on Gender Road or shop anytime at jeffweilercolumbus.com. That's jeffweilercolumbus.com.
Legislation is changing. Budgets are shifting. And terms like one big beautiful bill can feel anything but beautiful. That's where BHM CPA Group steps in. BHM's purpose is to simplify the complex. Their team is trained to meet today's challenges with real-world solutions in tax, accounting, and business planning. Get the clarity you deserve so that your business can thrive. Don't wait. Visit BHMCPAGroup.com. That's BHMCPAGroup.com. BHM. Because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's a moment in every criminal case where the ground shifts, where the strategy on one side suddenly collapses, and the tone of the entire trial changes. In the Brian Walsh case, that moment happened quietly, almost gently, in a courtroom where he stood in a dark suit, hands folded, and said three words that fundamentally altered the shape of his defense. Yes, Your Honor. It wasn't loud. It wasn't emotional. It didn't make the evening news as some explosive revelation, but to anyone watching closely, it was seismic because in that moment, Brian Walsh admitted he willfully conveyed the remains of his missing wife, Anna. He admitted he misled investigators. He admitted his actions interfered with the search for her and contributed to the destruction of key evidence. And something like that doesn't come undone. Kind of big. It stays stamped in the record, carved into the foundation of the trial. He didn't admit to murdering her. He's still on trial for murder. The case goes on. The trial will take place. But what happened is a fundamental shift in his admittance of guilt to elements of the case. From this moment on, everything about the case has changed. Not for the prosecution, who already believed that they had a mountain of circumstantial evidence, but for him, for Brian, and more importantly, for the story his defense team now has to tell the jury. Because Brian didn't plead guilty to something small. He didn't admit to a little procedural misstep. He admitted to handling the body of a woman who vanished under violent, suspicious circumstances. He admitted to making sure investigators couldn't find what they needed. He admitted to obstructing a homicide investigation, and yet he continues to plead not guilty to the actual murder itself. That contradiction is now the center of the entire trial. You can't pretend your wife walked out of the house alive when you've already admitted to picking up her body afterward. You can't claim innocence in the general sense when you've acknowledged moving the remains of a missing person without legal authorization. You can't frame yourself as the concerned, confused husband when you've admitted to misleading the people searching for her. And whether Brian realized it or not, the moment he changed those pleas, he forced his defense team into one of the tightest corners a lawyer can ever be asked to argue from. No more broad strokes about ignorance, no more vague denials, no more talk about miscommunication or misunderstandings. all of that evaporated. What's left is the narrowest, most fragile theory a defendant can try to stand on. Yes, he moved the body. Yes, he lied. Yes, he hid evidence. But no, he didn't kill her. He only panicked afterward. That's the defense now. That's the only defense now that's left. To understand how they'll try to sell that, you have to understand what the defense just lost, because the plea, they had room to maneuver. They could suggest Anna walked out. They could suggest she left voluntarily. They could suggest she met with harm from someone else. They could suggest the investigation was flawed, rushed, incomplete. They could suggest Brian wasn't involved at all, and that his behavior was simply the clumsy, confused reaction of someone overwhelmed by fear and scrutiny. You know, when you have fear and scrutiny and you go to Home Depot and buy cleaning supplies for getting rid of a body and Google the hell out of that. Every which way you can. There's nothing weird going on here. But you can't argue she walked out alive when you've admitted you handled her remains. You can't argue you thought she was fine when you admitted you disposed of her body. You can't claim innocence while simultaneously claiming you interfered with the investigation. The defense team knows this. They know what they've lost. And they know they're trying to build the case on what remains a strategically held together case of emotion, ambiguity, and the absence of a body. No body used to be a challenge for prosecutors. Now, it's the only lifeline the defense has left, because without a body, they can argue there is no cause of death. Without a cause of death, they can argue there's no medical proof of homicide. Without medical proof of homicide, they can argue prosecutors are asking the jury to make assumptions. And without direct evidence placing Brian inflicting violence on Anna, they can argue that the state has stitched together a story out of coincidences and panic rather than proof. Good luck selling that to the jury, though. That's what they're going to lean on. The emptiness, the missing pieces, the gaps. They'll turn the absence of a body into a shield because it's the one thing prosecutors can't fill in with lab reports or testimony. But to make that argument believable, the defense has to create a story that explains everything Brian now admits he did after Anna died. And that story cannot be elaborate. It cannot involve complicated theories or detailed alternative narratives. It has to be simple, relatable, emotionally grounded, and just plausible enough that a single juror might grab onto it. This is where they'll go. They'll say something happened to Anna, something sudden, something unexpected, something Brian didn't cause. They won't say what it was. They can't. They have no evidence to point to it. But they'll float the idea that maybe Anna fell. Maybe there was a medical event. Maybe an argument escalated into something tragic, but not intentional. Maybe she collapsed suddenly and Brian lacked the emotional capacity to handle it. They'll paint Brian not as a violent man, but as a fragile one. Someone depressed, overwhelmed, already crumbling under the pressure of his federal art fraud case. They'll argue he was living on borrowed time, that he feared prison, that he feared losing his children, that he feared his entire life imploding in front of him. And when Anna died, by whatever means they choose to imply, he broke. People do irrational things when they're afraid. People make terrible choices when they panic. People hide mistakes, hide accidents, hide tragedies because they're scared of the consequences. The defense will say Brian is guilty of panic, not murder. Guilty of cover-up, but not the crime. It's not a story built on evidence. It's a story built on emotion. The goal isn't to create an alternative timeline. It's to create reasonable doubt in the one piece the prosecution is going to be able to present. And that prosecution timeline is brutal. It's tight. It's detailed. It's lined with early morning Google searches that prosecutors say were made in the hours Anna was last alive. It's shaped by surveillance footage that allegedly shows Brian buying cleaning supplies the day after she vanished. It's supported by blood found in the basement, a damaged knife, and trash bags recovered from a transfer station miles away. The prosecution has a mountain of circumstantial evidence. The defense has to turn that mountain into a hill, and that hill into a mound of maybe. So they'll attack the searches. They'll argue they don't reflect planning, they reflect panic. They'll say people Google dark things all the time. They'll point to browsing habits, stress spirals, morbid curiosity. They'll argue that search history isn't proof of action, it's just proof of thought. They'll take the surveillance footage and argue that buying cleaning supplies doesn't prove murder. People clean basements. People scrub floors. They'll argue that gloves and masks in January aren't unusual. They'll suggest prosecutors are interpreting the tape through hindsight, not reality. They'll take the blood evidence and argue that blood in a home is not unusual. They'll go after the chain of custody. They'll question whether the knife was actually used violently. They'll say the blood stains could be old, misinterpreted, contaminated. They'll tear at every seam they can find. Then there's the trash, the bags found at the transfer station, the items linked to Anna. The defense knows this is bad, very bad. And now that Brian admitted to conveying the remains, they'll argue the trash bags reflect the disposal, not the murder. They'll say the presence of Anna's belongings is unsurprising. If Brian was panicking and trying to conceal what happened, they'll argue that the disposal is a crime, but not evidence of homicide. Their goal will be to separate the disposal from the cause of death, to drive a wedge between what Brian admits he did and what the prosecution says he did. They'll need those to be different stories, and they'll turn to motive. This is the part prosecutors feel strongest about. Jealousy, control, financial pressure, the alleged affair, the fight days before Anna disappeared. The defense has no choice but to dismantle it. They'll argue that the alleged affair is unproven. They'll say the marriage wasn't perfect, but it wasn't violent. They'll say stress doesn't equal murder. They'll say the fight was about the fraud case, not infidelity. And that Anna's own words, "choose life," support the idea that she wanted him to face consequences, not fear them. Everything the defense does will be aimed at creating the impression of ambiguity. They don't need to win the whole story. They just need the jury to hesitate. They need one person to say, "I'm not sure." And if that person exists, they have hope. And finally, the plea itself. This is the part the defense has to spin with surgical precision. They can't let it look like an admission of guilt on the murder at all. They have to present it in a very strategic, honest way. A man taking responsibility where he can, admitting to what he actually did wrong, and refusing to admit to something he says he didn't do, even though he's lied about it for the last 3 years. They'll argue the plea shows integrity. They'll argue it shows he's not running from everything, only the accusation he maintains is false. It won't be easy. It won't be clean. It won't be perfect. But this is the defense now. They've lost the wide open field. They're playing on a narrow strip of dirt, fenced in on all sides by Brian's own words. And they know it. The question is not whether they can prove Brian innocent. They can't. The question is whether they can convince one juror, just one, that the prosecution can't tie all these pieces together with enough certainty. One juror who believes accidents can look like crimes. One juror who believes panic can look like premeditation. One juror who believes concealment is not the same as homicide. That's the mission now. That's the strategy. That's the only defense they have left. And they're about to walk into a courtroom and try to sell it. Will they succeed? Yeah, probably not. But
anything is possible.
Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That is where you'll find us, and I'd love to get your thoughts. So please do comment there.
And hit subscribe wherever you're listening or watching, especially on YouTube right now. We are trying to get to 100,000 subscribers before the end of the year. We're getting close.
We might make it, but that's going to be up to you if you choose to hit subscribe on YouTube. So please do, so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases that we follow for you right here. I'm Tony Bruschi, and we will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.